Happy Healthy Tuesday, and welcome to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and as I like to do, we're going to start out this week with a little story to set the tone for today's conversation. So 30 years ago yesterday, my husband and I and our then five-year-old daughter set out on a four-month adventure in our, wait for it, 1968 Volkswagen bus. That's right. We had a 1968 pop-up Westphalia with a hand-painted sides and a beaded curtain, and we were off to explore the world, expand our horizons, learn new things. And I was 30 years old, and I was just coming into this new way of viewing the world and myself and my place in it. And part of the journey took us to a health food store in Eugene, Oregon, where I discovered the most sublime tofu dip and a very subversive magazine called Adbusters. Unfortunately, I lost track of the tofu dip somewhere in the last few decades, which makes me sad. But Adbusters has been a thought-provoking, often challenging, sometimes heartbreaking coffee table companion of mine for most of my adult life. And my guest today is Collie Lawson, who is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Adbusters and Adbusters Media Foundation. I'm so excited to have this conversation. So Adbusters and the Adbusters Media Foundation was described by Mr. Lawson in this way. It's a global network of artists, activists, writers, pranksters, students, educators, entrepreneurs, all devoted to challenging consumerism and opposing capitalism. Throughout its 32 years, Adbusters has launched many what might be familiar international campaigns, including Buy Nothing Day, TV Turnoff Week, and the Occupy Wall Street movement, which was a protest against economic inequality that began on September 17th, 2011 in Zuccotti Park in New York City's financial district and continued through November 15th of 2011 when the group was forced out of the park. In a 1996 interview, Collie Lawson talked about the foundation's goals. He said, "What we're trying to do is pioneer a new form of social activism using all the power of the mass media to sell ideas rather than products. We're motivated by a kind of green think that comes from the environmental movement and isn't mired in the old ideology of the left and right. Instead, we take the environmental ethic into the mental ethic, trying to clean up the toxic areas of our minds. You can't recycle and be a good environmental citizen and then go watch 4 hours of television and get consumption messages pumped at you." This conversation is one that I've looked forward to for many, many years, and I'm really happy that I get to share it with you today. So this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and although we aren't taking calls today, you can still add your thoughts on our Facebook page or follow us on Instagram. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org or subscribe however you find your podcasts, and you can listen to the show at any time. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX, and we'll be back in a minute to start our conversation with Collie Lawson of Adbusters.
Good times are over, didn't you know? Well, I heard it on the radio. Read in the paper, saw in the news, the golden age is all through.
How are you today?
Not too bad. It's a beautiful sunny day here in Vancouver. It's a little chilly, but there's full sun and all my potatoes are growing.
That's a good day. So did you get the next edition put to bed?
Yes, we put it to bed on last Thursday. And it felt really good. It felt like another mind bomb. And it'll hit the newsstands in, 2 or 3 weeks.
And so how many issues is that? Do you just know off the top of your head? What number was that?
That was issue number, I can't believe it, 155.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, so that's the last 30 years of my life, you know, coming up with a half a dozen or more issues every year after year after year. It's an incredible treadmill I've been on.
Did you feel like it was going to go on this long? I mean, I noticed that you're 79. Did you just turn 80 in March?
No, I turned 79. I'll be 80 next March.
Okay.
Yeah. It kept on changing, you know, the original mood that we were in, you know, 30 years ago when we were, you know, just discovering the environmental movement and realizing that that there's a bit of an impending existential crisis looming on the horizon. That morphed into a psychological angle there about how the media is misinforming us, and then especially the last 10 years or so, there's that existential crisis has intensified, and it looks like we are in big trouble, you know. So in a way, it's been a journey, not just in putting out an issue of AdBuzzers, but also sort of, you know, like a self-education. It's almost like I've grown for the last 30 years to the point where now I'm ready to fight for the survival of the human race.
Mm-hmm. That's a daunting task, but
indeed, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a strange kind of a moment where we're living through it, kind of ignoring the obvious. We're ignoring the fact that global warming is looming on the horizon, and that we're in an era of chronic financial instability. And I wake up every morning almost half expecting that the Dow Jones has crashed, you know, and we're in another 1929 scenario. And then on top of that, strange, weird stuff is happening, like a huge percentage of America is, you know, believes that Trump is still the president of the United States, and that the climate change isn't really happening, and there's this big lie going on, and I'm thinking, my God, you know, where are we heading, you know, and on top of everything, of course, on a global level, there's a kind of a populist uprising happening everywhere, a populist wave that's crashing over us, and people are scared, and they're buying into the Trumps and the Bolsonaros and the Orbans and the Le Pens, and they're feeling kind of deep down, they may be euphoric on a sort of we're coming out of COVID level, but on another level, deep down, I think they, you know, they need therapy, and we, the people of the world, are buying into it.
And maybe that's what's disheartening, is on one hand, there's a lot of awakening happening. You know, part of the things I wanted to talk to you about was the Gen Z, because they may be the closest thing to a revolutionary mind that we've had in three generations. You know, the Gen X flopped, and, you know, the millennials are kind of lost, but the Gen Z seem to get it, and they're loud and they're educated. And I keep thinking, how do we bridge you and the wisdom of your generation with the Gen Zs? Because if Gen Zs try to reinvent the wheel again, then I see us just in this continuous cycle that every few generations, one group gets riled up, but it's not enough to shift the ship, I guess. Mm. You know, it's funny because I don't want to make you retell your whole life story, but I know that a lot of my listeners don't have an intimate knowledge of AdBuzzers in the background. So I want to back up, because it will connect to the Gen Z, to why you even got started.
Yeah, back in the 1960s, I graduated from university and paid off my 3 years that I owed the Australian government, you know, and then I finished up in Tokyo, Japan, started my own company, and started giving intelligence to the marketing intelligence to the advertising companies in Tokyo at the time, made a ton of money, but ultimately got disillusioned with the ethic that all those ad people had, you know, incredibly creative people, but somehow politically totally tuned out in some way. So I got disillusioned and I left, and then I traveled around the world, and I really got politicized, you know, when I traveled through India and saw how people were dying in the streets of Calcutta, and when I traveled through Mexico and Central America, and learned about the history of political involvement in those countries, and then of course the Vietnam War was happening, and all of a sudden my lifelong love affair with America, and my father's and my mother's lifelong love affair with America all of a sudden started dying during the Vietnam War, when I realized that something wasn't quite right with what was going on. And so bit by bit, my life started turning around in a sort of a more of an angry direction. And eventually it gave birth to a bunch of documentary films that I made for the National Film Board of Canada, and eventually 30 years ago to the birth of Adbusters Media Foundation.
And so what was that moment where you'd had enough? What was the first ad busting that you did, kind of turning your skills as a advertiser marketer back on the world?
Well, I had many, many moments, but one of the really big moments that gave birth to Adbusters magazine and everything we've done since was that here in the Pacific Northwest, there was a logging industry, and they were cutting down the old growth forests like you wouldn't believe. And a few of us filmmakers and environmentalists got together, and we said, we have to sort of talk back against this industry. And at that time, the industry had a campaign called Forest Forever. And they were 30-second TV spots and full-page ads in newspapers and all kinds of bus stop ads. And they were basically saying to British Columbians we're doing a fantastic job managing your forests, so you have nothing to worry about. You have forests forever. So that's the moment we decided to fight back. We came up with our own 30-second TV spot. And then the big moment came when I went to the TV, the commercial TV stations, and I tried to buy airtime for our TV spot on the same stations that the forest industry was buying airtime, and they refused to sell me the airtime. They said that, oh, Mr. Larson, your spot isn't really an ad. It's some sort of a polemic, and it's, we don't really want to run it, so we don't want to take your money. And to me, that was sort of one of those moments when I just felt the tightness in my gut, rising up in a way like it's really done before, because I was born in Estonia, a place where the Soviet Union for 50 years didn't allow the Estonian people to talk back against the government. And here I was, many, many years later in the land of the free and the home of the brave, so to speak. And here all of a sudden I found out that you're not allowed to speak back against the sponsor. You're not allowed to speak back against the big boys. And that really stuck in my craw. And that that feeling that the people at the top are somehow controlling things too much, that has stayed with me for 30 years.
One of the first magazines, and I use this still in my classes, it's so dated, and I wish you would do another issue around this, but it was the whole kind of marketing trajectory from the Steinway piano, when, before that there was no advertising, but the Steinway piano people hit on how they could sell things to people they didn't need. And I think in that issue you talked about how the United States government kind of made a deal with the devil of Madison Avenue and said, if you'll help us market World War II, we won't regulate you after that. And that was the dawn of the consumer world. Do you recall that piece?
Of course, I recall. Yeah, I especially recall that those old ads about the pianos and that whole progression of how advertising slowly, grew from this very modest little industry into this gigantic $1 trillion-a-year industry that it is now, and how their techniques became ever more emotionally coercive, and now, of course, in this internet age we live in, I mean, we don't even know half the things that are happening to us. We don't quite know how those algorithms of Facebook and Google, how they actually work. So I've watched, having been in the advertising industry myself, a long, long time ago, all of a sudden I've watched this advertising industry, turn into a monster, into something that divides people and perpetrates big lies, and it feels like the truth isn't, like I always thought the truth was something solid, that if you really tried and you could get a handle on the truth and you could be rational about things and figure things out and push the world in some benign direction. And lately it doesn't feel like that. It feels like the truth is up for grabs. Whoever's got the biggest budget, whoever's got the biggest lobbying power in Washington, whoever's You know, so everybody's perpetrating their own lie. You know, so you know the Trump people are perpetrating the big lie, and in Israel the Israelis have their own lie about the Palestinians, and in Hungary Orban has got his own lie, and the Chinese government now is getting heavily involved in shooting its own information system into the world, and they're trying to have their you know their lie. So basically, we're sort of instead of talking about the truth, we're talking about a clash of lies. I don't think that we can sort of work our way out of the existential crisis that we're in. You know, if we continue to be stuck in this in these lies.
Well, and I guess it kind of tying it back to your first attempt to buy airtimes. The message was, oh no, we control the message, that shift from being human beings and citizens to consumers.
Yeah, I think that's the big danger right now, that we're in a moment where life is difficult. People are, especially during COVID, you know, all those hundreds of thousands of restaurants that went out of business and independent business sort of lost and big business won. And I think that people are looking at the future with a very ominous feeling. They feel mm-hmm. that the future doesn't really compute, and then you know, when your own future is at stake, when you don't quite know how to pay your rent, next month's rent, or you don't quite know what your next job is going to be, or you don't quite know whether you can afford some health care, you know, down the road if you get sick, when you're living in a precarious life, then it's so easy to buy into the big lie. We on the left, I mean, I consider myself a left, kind of a lefty, even though I sort of hate what the left has done recently. It's been totally ineffective in so many ways, but I still see myself as a lefty. And I just heard on the news recently that one of my heroes, the guy who launched the Podemos movement in Spain, he suddenly was completely outcompeted in the last some sort of election that they had in Spain there, and some very right wing candidate won the election there, and Podemos is toast now. Podemos is sort of a bit of a sparky rising thing that happened a few years ago, and now this kind of a very very interesting powerful left wing movement that was using the internet in interesting ways to get people to vote on the internet and get together on the internet and do things and so on. Somehow it disappeared. It was eclipsed, you know, by the extreme right. And that's the one big feeling that I have right now, is that the world is sort of moving in a wrong direction, and this human experiment of ours on planet Earth, you know, maybe spiraling into some sort of a long dark age. But at the same time, it's an opportunistic moment. It's a moment when we can you know, we can somehow rise up and start pushing some systemic changes that need to happen and work our way out of this crisis that we're in.
There's a lot of hubris in humans to think that we would not fall back into a dark ages. You know, if everything else recycles, why wouldn't we go through another dark ages? Where we are is we're tipping back into an age of dark narrative.
And yeah, it's some sort of mystical, strange mm-hmm. moment that we're living through, and I'm getting the feeling that it's so easy. It's easier than we can possibly imagine to actually tip into that dark age. It's that we, you know, on the one hand, we think we're all rational and we all understand what's going on in the world, and we're looking at Gen Z and say, hey, they can save us, and technology yes. has got a lot to give us, and you know, we're sort of trying to stay positive, but at the same time, there's this feeling that we're not quite aware of the fact about how easy it would be for this global system of ours to suddenly start bickering and start suddenly falling into some sort of a you know, fight over the water in the Ganges between Pakistan and India mm-hmm. and strange religious cults, you know, sort of yes. springing up all over the world, and somehow a third world war breaking out, and some sort of a you know, a 1929's financial meltdown, maybe even much, much bigger than what happened in 1929. And all of a sudden, lo and behold, you know, suddenly we're sort of tipping into this system where, as some poet said, you know, like all of a sudden the center doesn't no longer holds. And then suddenly we're in an irretrievable situation that we can't control anymore. And all of a sudden, we, you know, we haven't just polluted the planet, and now we're starting to pollute the atmosphere around the planet. But at the same time, of course, this is you know, this the fact that we're reaching out into the space and finding out what it's like to be on Mars and of course landing people on the moon and all the rest of it. I mean, there's something incredibly delightful about all that.
Mm. So at one point you said the car is the worst invention ever to happen to the human population. Do you still believe that to be true?
I'm not so sure anymore. I have a feeling that the car is a beautiful example of how technology gives us something, you know, some sort of a hypermobility and then somehow we embrace it fully and it changes the way we live and the way we get around and now suddenly it's quite the normal for the average human being in the rich countries of the world, you know, to travel around in a car for hundreds of thousands of miles during his or her lifetime and then suddenly we find out that, oh my God, you know, there's all this carbon that we've been pumping mm-hmm. into the atmosphere because of our cars and all of a sudden we're in an existential crisis and I'm wondering, well, you know, why is it that we sort of don't think of the precautionary principle, or that we don't sort of think ahead a little bit more, and somehow we continually fall into these technological traps, I guess you could call them, mm-hmm. where we embrace something and then all of a sudden we found that, oops, you know, we just shot ourselves in the foot, or maybe even endangered the future survival of the whole human race.
Yeah, so, it is crazy how we go all in. Because technology has felt like that there was not a second that someone said, I wonder if we should be carrying these in our pocket. What will that do to our mental health? I mean, because that's my field. And so I want to go through the seven pieces, the seven critical fronts that you've talked about, the metamines. That you have proposed, Adbuster is proposing that we need to attack these seven different areas in order to kind of turn the course. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to, I'm not going to go in order because I want to save the psychological, but
let's talk about the eco front first, if you don't mind, because you just talked about cars. Cars is, so basically cars. So what we have right now is a situation, excuse me, where we have an existential crisis of climate change. Nobody mm-hmm. quite knows how to fix it. For 40 years, we've been talking about it and somehow haven't really come up with a solution to it. Carbon tax is probably the best idea we've come up with so far, but somehow it seems to be stuck. You know, there's a debate going about, you know, whether we really need a carbon tax and whether we should have it. It's become a political football. So one of our big metamemes, one of the big ideas, the eco metameme, is this idea of a two-cost global marketplace. This idea that if we go one step beyond even the carbon tax and we say, instead of the carbon tax, let's basically up the price of every product so it tells the ecological truth. Mm-hmm. So that you buy a car. Instead of paying the $25,000 just for the price of making the car and adding on a bit of profit for General Motors or for Toyota, you all of a sudden say, all right, well, this car is going to pump out, you know, $50,000 worth of carbon into the atmosphere over its lifetime. So why are we only paying $25,000 for the car and then basically leaving it to future generations to clean up the $50,000 worth of damage that the car has done? So why don't we have a two-cost marketplace of cars where we actually pay the true cost of what the car, costs everybody? If you think about it, just about every product in the global marketplace is mispriced. It doesn't tell the ecological truth. And I think it's a wonderful vision of the future is for us, the people, and for Gen Z and all the people that feel that we're sort of heading in the wrong direction to say, all right, well, it may take a few years and it may be a little hard to do, but why don't we start segueing, moving slowly, inexorably towards a global economic system where the price of every product tells the ecological truth. And it wouldn't be that super hard to do it. Once we agree to do it and once economists start calculating the true cost of products, then we could use the UPC code. which is just about on every product on the world now. It would be very easy. So whenever you buy something, then they scan the UPC code and automatically the cost is either taken off. You know, if it's a bicycle, maybe we want to reduce the cost because it's so good. But maybe a car, we need to sort of or a plastic bottle of Coke or whatever. You know, you scan it, and all of a sudden, you know, it adds on, 25 cents for the fact that you just bought a plastic bottle. And there's something I really like about this idea of a two cost future.
And so, even an apple that you bought that came from Washington, you're going to pay for the gas that it took to drive the apple down to California, correct? So that apple is $50 instead of 50 cents.
Yeah, or better still here, I noticed that here in British Columbia, where I live, we grow a lot of apples here, and you know, it's a really good, the nature is really good for growing apples here. And yet, you know, I go to the supermarket or I go to some food store and I find that, you know, here are some apples from New Zealand, and I'm looking at it and saying, you know, how come the apples from New Zealand are actually cheaper than the apples in British Columbia? It sounds crazy to me, the fact that that they don't add on the cost of putting that apple, you know, in a container ship and shipping the apple over all the way thousands of miles from New Zealand and somehow are still selling it to me at some bargain price. To me, that is a metaphor of what's exactly wrong with the global marketplace and why we need to fix it.
And so the question is the equity piece, how do we work with that? Because if it's going to cost, you know, $70,000 for a vehicle or $50 for an apple, how does the ecological true cost market adjust for inequities in wealth?
Yeah, well, that's the question that we on the left always ask. And I think we can adjust, and I think we must adjust it. I think we can fix inequity. There's all kinds of other ways of fixing this huge gap between the rich and the poor. And I don't think that we have to sacrifice our the ecological future of the planet, you know, on the altar of inequity. I think we can fix inequity and fix the climate crisis at the same time. I think that's one of the Achilles heels of the political left, is that they you know, even when a really good idea like true cost comes up, they sort of try to throw cold water on it and say, this isn't quite right and so on. I think that we on the left have to be bolder. We have to come up with these big ideas, these systemic ideas like true cost and some of the other meta memes and come up with a new vision of what the future of the planet could look like if we, rather than the Trumps and the Bolsonaros and the Orbans and the Le Pens, start calling the shots. So we the people have to start learning the shots from below, calling the shots from below in a way like we've never done before.
You're listening to Kali Lawson, Editor-in-Chief of Adbusters Magazine and Media Foundation, which was founded in 1989 to challenge the toxicity of our consumerist culture, combating the negative effects of advertising, and encouraging readers to regain control of culture and ask themselves whether they are consumers or citizens. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You're tuned in to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back in a moment to continue our conversation with our self-proclaimed culture jammer, Kali Lawson.
Days, cliches and throwaways, trying to learn better ways, but it's getting harder to survive. Change moments that rearrange. The only fight that remains is called keeping hope alive.
For me, it's the retelling of the narrative of what a quality of life looks like. Because I think part of the challenge of changing to a true cost or changing anything in our culture is that we have to change how people determine that they are living a good life and what it takes
because it's the idea that we have to be consuming and having things that I think prevent any change. Because if we're marking equity or equality on everybody having a car, everyone getting to go to Disneyland, then it's not ever going to be fair. And if we're able to say your mental health should be the highest predictor of how well you're doing, and if people put all their energy into that, then the things would become less important, and it would be, I don't know if that's where you're thinking, but that's kind of my self-word, is that it's the whole essence of what we've determined we deserve that hurts us.
Yeah, no, I think I really like what you just said. That to me, that's right on the button. And if we had, if we ushered in like a two-cost global market regime, you know, where every product told the ecological truth, and that would of course force us to, you know, after a while, if you can't afford to buy a, you know, a plastic bottle of Coca-Cola, then maybe you'll add a little titch of lemon, you know, to a glass of water and drink that instead, and that'll save, you know, one plastic bottle, you know, floating around the ocean. So and if you can't afford to buy a car for $75,000, then maybe you'll stand up and become politicized and ask your government to come up with a monorail system in your city or in your neighborhood, or you'll come up with some sort of a share, you know, sharing the, you know, like have one car that's being shared by a number of people. And there's all kinds of other ways for us to get around. You know, we don't have to sit in this couple of tons of metal, you know, with the music playing and cruising down the highway. And this is not necessarily the way to live. So in a way, you know, you can say that the two-cost marketplace would squeeze a lot of poor people. And I agree, that would be that's a hurdle we have to overcome. But at the same time, I think it would push the, you know, the rich 1 billion people on the planet to basically start consuming less and thinking more about what sort of a life is really a life that's worth living.
And if they started feeling better with less stuff, you know, because we just need 20% of the population to start thinking differently to change the whole
even
culture.
Less than that, even 5% could to do it if they're vocal enough. Yeah, I think so. It just takes a tiny little number of people to sort of launch a fantastic new idea that suddenly gets traction and takes off. I mean, think of Me Too, think of BLM. I mean, these are two ideas that suddenly sort of curveballs into the global system that suddenly changed everything for a lot of people.
Right, and you can be comfortable with the status quo, and so you have to change as well.
Yeah, I think the true cost can be something like a Me Too. I think a true cost revolution could be sort of a moment of truth for all the rich people of the world when we suddenly realize, yeah, the time has come, you know, to sort of take our overconsumption seriously and to realize that, you know, that we are setting a horrible role model for the rest of the world. And if the whole world, you know, aspires to live the way we do, then this human experiment of ours on planet Earth will have zero future.
Agreed. So we're talking about the metamemic insurrection, the seven critical fronts that you've been writing about in Adbusters. And I'm just going to list them. And then we talked about the ecological front, but the seven include: we need to go after change on the psychological front, the corporate front, the financial front, the economic front, the political front, the aesthetic front, and the ecological front. And we just touched into
seven fronts.
The seven. It's a lot of work.
I don't know why it turned out to be seven. Yeah, it's a lot of work.
You've got a lot of stuff to do. So we need to get busy. So we talked a little bit about the ecological. Which one do you want to hit next?
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, the way I see the corporate front is that that corporations, which started off, you know, at the time of the American Revolution, and when we, the people, were totally in control of those corporations. I mean, we gave charters to the corporation only if we really felt like it. And if a corporation misbehaved, we would revoke their charter. We would, we the people in the early days of the American Revolution, we kept corporations on a very short leash. Mm-hmm. And we called the shots and we were in control. And yet, over the last many, many years, there's been a number of legal victories, incremental legal victories, and corporations became increasingly powerful within, and they're the ones that give us our jobs, and they're the ones who and they've won all these legal victories that culminated in the Citizens United thing, where all of a sudden they have all the rights and freedoms of human beings. They are literally new kinds of human beings, you know, that are living among us. for me, there is an unofficial history of America. And it is a very sad story. It's a story of rugged individualism and a heroic personal sacrifice, you know, in the pursuit of a revolutionary dream. It's basically the story of a democracy derailed. It's a story of a people that have suddenly become in servitude to corporations. We are suddenly not in control of our destiny anymore. We are now sort of in servitude to corporations. The corporations rule us rather than the other way around. And I think that if we're going to have any kind of a future on this planet, then we have to take back that power. We have to, when a corporation breaks the public trust in some way, then we have to come down heavy on them, and we have to learn how to decide that a few corporations aren't really fit to live among us. You know, like for example, Purdue Pharma that has killed 500,000 people on opioids, or Exxon Mobil that is guilty of delaying the debate on climate change by 10 years and possibly shafting our future by doing that. When corporations pull off heinous, horrible crimes like that result in death and so on, then we should be wiping those corporations off the face of the earth. But we're not. We're sort of slapping them with a fine and letting them get away with it. They take out another full-page ad in the New York Times. People forget. The 24/7 news cycle moves on. And before you know it, they're perpetrating further crimes down the road.
We need to have the birth of a corporate charter revocation movement.
Yeah, because what we the people forget is that the corporation is a legal construct. A corporation, if it wants to exist, then it has to come to the people. It has to go to the attorney general of the state of Delaware or any state that they want. And they have to say, okay, we want to become a corporation. And here is our corporate charter. And when we grant a corporation a charter, then we basically give them the privilege of existence. We actually say, look, okay, we'll give you a charter and you can live among us from now on. But at the same time, we can also add clauses to that charter. You know, we can say to, for example, we can add to the Facebook charter, we can say, okay, you can start your thing and you can start operating your algorithm. But at the same time, you have to be transparent. You cannot collect the information on people and not tell them how you're doing it. You can't have an algorithm that you keep secret from the people that you're harvesting their personal data. And if we included a clause like that in the Facebook data and the Facebook corporate charter, then all of a sudden the whole destiny of Facebook would be changed. Mm-hmm. So we the people have the power through the corporate charters, to take back control. And I think this is one of the big ideas that I hope will become part of the vision of the new left.
And so we have the ecological front, the corporate front. Let's talk about the financial front. What needs to change there? What insurrection needs to happen?
Again, the story of money. Like I was thinking yesterday how important money is. Money is actually something really, really deep that we never really think about, but it's actually the primary way that we sort of exchange stuff with each other, right? Like it is something so sacred. It's the sacred way that we the people deal with each other, and yet somehow money has been sullied. It got sullied a few hundred years ago when we first allowed usury, when we first allowed, we said, okay, well, people are allowed to sort of make money off money, and they can charge interest. And that was possibly something that maybe we shouldn't have done, we should have kept the money a little more sacred than allowing people to make money off money, which doesn't feel quite right. And then after that, of course, there came the derivatives, and there came fast trading on the stock exchanges, and we had credit default swaps, and we had the sort of stuff that was happening during the 2008 meltdown, when all of a sudden we found out that these bogus mortgages were being sold and packaged in. So all of a sudden, finance has become, in a sense, corporations maybe rule the world, but behind corporations is finance, and we've kind of taken money we've come up with a financial architecture that I think is corrupt. And I think one of the big seven fights that we have to fight if we're going to have a new vision of the future is, you know, we have to sort of come up with reverse money flows. We have to sort of take that that money-making power away from some of the banks and from the stock markets and sort of come up with a new way that we the people can sort of exchange stuff with each other that isn't corrupt. And so for me, the step number one, if we the people want to take power away from big finance, then move your money. Go into, if you have your money right now sitting in the Bank of America or some of the other big banks, then take that money out, do a bit of research in where you live and find out some sort of a financial, more community-based financial institution that you can believe in and put all your money there.
I have two thoughts follow up on that. One, where does Bitcoin in that world fit into our money moving forward, the financial front moving forward? And number two, I keep thinking that money itself, you know, gold is just a rock we dug out of the ground and then we decided it had value. I mean, what happens if, you know, Bitcoin and this new kind of world of fast money and fast trades, if people just stop believing in money at all?
That's a sort of very question mark area, and I don't quite understand it enough to talk neither. About it. It used to be very, very clear, you know, you give me a chicken and I'll give you a I'll give you a pig or whatever. And
yes. The darker side of me, I just kind of keep going back to the quality of life piece. And as long as we have people willing to spend 10 hours a day to get money so that they can buy things that, you know, they should have been able to get for free, like water and food, that money is another part of the serfdom, you know, that they were willing, people will do anything for the gold rocks. And that for me is, that's where the shift has to be, away from the idea that there's even any value in chasing the gold rock.
Well, yeah, I think maybe I'm too dark. You're coming up with a deeper angle on it. I agree with you there. I think it's actually, you're on the button there. But I think it's possible, you know, in this age that we live in, you know, where there's 8-9 billion people on the planet and we're doing business with each other in all kinds of complicated ways. I think it is possible to come up with a means of exchange, money, in other words, to find ways of paying each other for our services and our goods and exchanging stuff. I think we can come up with an exchange system that isn't as corrupt as the one that we have now. We have to sort of kill off big finance and come up with a more bottoms up kind of a way of exchanging value with each other.
You're tuned into a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Kali Lawson, founder and editor-in-chief of Adbusters Magazine, which has been challenging consumerist culture, capitalism, and income and environmental inequality for over 30 years. Adbusters Media Foundation has inspired many international movements, including Buy Nothing Day, TV Turnoff Week, and the Occupy Wall Street protest. We continue our conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Was Occupy Wall Street a success?
In my mind, it was. It could have gone better, but it was a success. It politicized the whole generation of young people. It got a lot of people thinking about inequity and you know, the 99% and the 1%, and it created a kind of a new anarchic model of living together in parks, you know, that taught a lot of people about what real life can be all about. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me very much of 1968, which was the Occupy Wall Street of my life, you know, when all of a sudden there was this little uprising that happened in the Latin Quarter of Paris, and then it turned into this worldwide explosion of youthful revolutionary fervor. And I think that's what Occupy Wall Street did. It was an explosion of youthful revolutionary fervor, and I never thought of it as being, you know, when we launched that meme and when we launched that all the stuff that we did there to sort of spark the whole thing, I never imagined that it would suddenly solve all the problems of the world. I just thought of it as being a step along the way, just like 1968 was a step along the way for me.
I agree. And I love the idea of it reminded young people that living and working together as a community was going to be more powerful than individuals you know, yelling into the wind. And yeah, that's what I see moving forward, is much more teamwork, community-based actions.
Yeah, and maybe next time, there's a kind of Occupy Wall Street or a 1968, then if we can have an Occupy Wall Street for every one of those meta memes, you know, like have a series of global Big Bang moments where young people rise up and say, we want two-cost markets. You know, we want criminal corporations that have broken the public trust to be wiped off the face of the earth, and you know, basically to stand up and ask for the really big systemic changes that need to happen if we are going to have any kind of future. I think the Occupy Wall Street was a good, wonderful step along the way.
Agreed. And so let's dive into the aesthetic front, because that kind of, that's where Adbusters started, was going after the mindscape. I think at the time, one of the early editions, it was 40,000 corporate messages that we were ingesting. Was it every day or every week? And who knows how much we're ingesting that? Let's talk about the aesthetic front and what needs.
Yeah, well, I think that you know, on one level, we have to talk about the fact that there's this incredible number of marketing messages that are flowing into our brains every day, and we have really no idea what sort of an influence it has on our lives. You know, if we grow up in a culture that is starting to bombard you, you know, with commercial messages and continually telling you that you can be happy if you consume and so on, and also sometimes also using emotional blackmail to sort of get you to buy stuff, then of course it's bad for our mental health. And I don't think that that we should be living in a culture that is so thoroughly full of advertising. But I think there's a bigger fish to fry here. I think like what we've created is a kind of an ambience. Like we live, all of us live in an ambience where, you know, you turn on the TV and every few minutes, you know, these ads come on. You know, even when there's some sort of a horrible tragedy happening with COVID, and there's all kinds of stuff that we should be thinking and talking about. Oh no! But another batch of ads comes on, tells us to consume more, and even during a political debate, all of a sudden they will interrupt the political debate and have some ads coming on, and so all of a sudden the whole of television has a kind of a commercial ambience to it, and we've gotten used to it, But should we have gotten used to it? And should we get used to the fact that our cities are full of billboards and that our all our shoes are constantly flashing logos? And so basically, on a deeper sort of aesthetic level, what sort of an aesthetic have we created? It's a bogus commercial kind of an aesthetic. Mm-hmm. Our whole lives are swimming in this ambience that... you know, that has got this sort of a commercial edge to it, and I personally dream of a more pure kind of an ambience. I have a feeling that the creative people of the world, the designers and the artists, and we the people who think visually and come up with you know, with the sort of moods and the tones. I'm calling for a tone shift away from commercial aesthetic towards some sort of a new aesthetic that we have yet still to discover what it is. But I know that it should never be anywhere near as commercial as the current ambience that we live in.
And how easily people are willing to be marketing tools themselves, you know, wearing brands and wanting to driving a certain car or using a certain product, that we don't even realize, or maybe people don't realize, that they're just walking billboards. They used to be being paid by the corporations to wear their clothes or drive their car. Yeah. So I don't know. So yeah. I don't know how we pull the aesthetic back. I know.
Yeah, but you know, it's difficult because after a while, if you grow up in a culture like a commercial culture like ours, then in a way it becomes invisible. You know, it's a little bit like you know, you buy a house next to a freeway, and for the first few days, you know, you hear the freeway and say, oh my God, you know, I've got to get out of here because that freeway is so noisy, you know, I can't go to sleep at night because the cars are whizzing by and stopping me from going to sleep. But then after a week or so, you stop hearing the cars, and all of a sudden everything is fine again. And that's what commercial culture has done to us. It's crept up on us slowly, and it's taken over, you know, our culture in a way that the previous generations would find totally disgusting. And yet somehow we've gotten used to it. We never even think about it anymore. It's like the air we breathe.
We don't even see that we're prisoners of that cultural story. So let's go to the psychological front. What needs to change on our psychological front? Because that's near and dear to my heart. What's the proposal?
The proposal is that, again, we have to think deeper. We have to get to the crux of the problem. And I think the crux of the problem is that we spend a huge number of hours every day living in a virtual environment. And so in this virtual environment, we don't have any rights yet. We allow, Mark Zuckerberg to basically mine our personal data, not even tell us what he's taking from us. The next step in this digital evolution, this digital revolution that we're caught up in, the next step would be to create a new human rights for all of us to start thinking about what sort of a human rights do we need to have in a digital age. If we can pull off that kind of a mind shift, then I think a lot of the horrible problems that we're having right now with the internet and with the dominance of the big platforms, that they would slowly dissolve away, and we could, we could sort of realize some of the early wonderful dreams about what the internet could really be.
Right, of bringing people together and actually forming communities that solve big problems.
I think we should expand our human rights to include our inalienable right to our own personal data.
Well, and as you've said, we need more global human rights. You said on the political front that we have to be the human body of the globe and not just of our individual countries or states, that we need to command power globally as citizens and not just consumers.
We need to think of that. We need to think about the physical body and the virtual body and how in the future, in the 21st century, we're going to have a different kind of a body than we had in the 20th century, and we'd better figure out what are the human rights that we have in the 21st century.
So do you, in your 79th year and 30 years into Adbusters, what gives you energy to keep doing this? What drives you right now at this time in your life?
Well, what drives me is that I feel that this human experiment of ours on planet Earth is at some sort of a point where it can either go, take the red pill and go in some bad direction, or take the blue pill and go in a better direction. So in a way, like we're in a kind of a moment where we can, it's an incredibly, on the one hand, it's a very dark moment where we could spiral into a long dark age. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's an incredibly opportunistic moment where we can suddenly pull off, these metamimetic changes that could be the humanity's vision in the future. And when I think about, these seven meta memes that we've been brainstorming about at Adbusters for the last while, and then I'm thinking, my God, we may be onto something here. We may actually, be coming up with a new vision for the people on the planet, something that the Gen Z can actually cotton onto and say, all right, from now on, we're going to start fighting for these seven meta memes. And if we can make progress on all those seven meta memes, then we can actually create a future that computes. And there's something so hopeful about that. And in the midst of all this negativity that's floating around, I feel that, that it's my responsibility with what energy I have left to take those meta memes and throw them at the world.
And the enthusiasm in your voice, it sounds like you just started this magazine last year.
I still have this feeling that this journey that I've been on for the last 30 years, that it can still culminate in some sort of a big bang, global big bang moment.
And I am on this journey with you because that we're one generation away from shifting. And if we could do it through education, if we can raise a generation of kids, we just have to sell them a different narrative. They have to see commercials every day of a natural world that's clean and beautiful. Part of me is like, why can't we just market a post-consumerist story, and that people just see it every day because we're such sheep. But if you saw it, remember back in the 60s when they wanted us to stop littering and they used the indigenous Native American with the tear rolling down his eye. I don't know if you saw that in Canada, but.
I remember that. Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
And nobody littered in my generation because you would think of that PSA. So under this simplistic form, I keep thinking Adbusters, just start marketing a whole different story so that one generation, all we need is one generation to see an alternative way of living, and that becomes their norm. Like the economics didn't touch on, that the economics, if you could get professors to teach their students a different lens, that's all it would take is one generation to shift it. Because once you have the awakening, you can't unsee it, that we're going the wrong way.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think the Gen Z is the generation that can perhaps do that, because I don't know whether we have enough time for them to actually do it. But, but by the time the high school Gen Z, the person who's walking out of class on Friday, by the time they get to be in their 20s and 30s and 40s, and you know, then they can throw those metamimetic curveballs into the global system, and they can fundamentally change the way the global system works. And I believe that if we can pull off these systemic changes on all those seven fronts, then, you know, then we do have a future.
I agree.
We on the left are mucking around with cancel culture and being woke and staring at our own navel. And I think above all, I think there should be some sort of a new hybrid culture, you know, beyond left and beyond right. And, mm-hmm. and maybe the Gen Z can be that sort of beyond the left and the right kind of a generation that can, that can come up with a new vision for the future that can sort of pull us out of this sort of a existential crisis that we're in.
The funk.
The funk. That's a good word. Yeah.
Get us out of the funk. If you had the ear of the people charging the left forward, what would you want to say to them?
I would say, stop mucking around on the surface and go deeper. Go deeper.
What is the book you mentioned? What's coming up next for you?
Yeah, I'm sort of putting every chapter of the book that we write every 2 months, putting it into the magazine. And then we're sort of halfway through that process now. And then down the road, maybe end of this year or early next year, we're going to publish a book that's either going to be called Poof Goes the Old World Order, or it's going to be called The Third Force, A Field Guide to a New World Order.
I love that. So, Kali, thank you again. Getting to talk to you is, I feel like I don't have to do my show much longer, because I feel like I've got to talk to the person who most influenced how I've led my life as an adult. So thank you for that.
Yeah, well, thank you for phoning me, because I find it so easy to talk to you. You're sort of a nice person to talk to. You.
Thank you, Kali. I really enjoyed it. Take care.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to A Conversation with Kali Lawson, founder and editor-in-chief of Adbusters Magazine. If you've missed any of our conversation today, it will be available shortly at kcbx.org. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and thank you for tuning in and doing your part to support programs like this here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Don't give up, although you can see all the world and the rest that we're making. Can't give up and hope God would intercede. Come on back, imagine that we could get it together, stand on for what we need to be. 'Cause crying won't save or feed a hungry child. Can't lay down and wait for some miracle to change things. So lift up your eyes, lift up your heart, singing mercy will your kindness. Mercy will
come over us. Oh, one by one, come we turn it around. What's